この場にて忘れまや。この場にて忘れまや。ランバマナ。カラタラム。ランバマナカラタラム。ランバマナカラタラム。Pada cha virikan mahim Pada cha virikan mahim Pada cha virikan mahim Rambhamana kataram Pada cha virikan mahim Udyamya Pucham Vaprani Udyamyam Pucham Vaprani Udyamya Pucham Vaprani Vishangnagrena Chodharam Vishanangrena Chodharam Vishanam Yena Chodharam Udyamya Pucham Vaprani Vishanam Yena Chodharam Kinchit Kinchich Chakrin Muncham Kinchich Kinchich Chakrin Muncham Kinchit kinchit chakran muncham Mutrayan stabdha lochana Mutrayan stabdha lochana Mutrayan stabdha lochana Kinchit kinchit chakran muncham Mutrayan stabda lochana Rambamana kataram Padacha vidikhanmahim Udyamya pucham vaprani Vishanagrena chodaram Kinchit kinchit chakrin chakran munchan Mutrayan stabda lochana Rambamana kram Most harshly. So it's interesting here, it's describing that Aristasura, he's coming to the village of Braj. And he's gigantic. He's not just like, you know, like you see sometimes. I remember when I used to work up in Queensland, they'd have these bulls there, and on the railways they have these wagons where they put the cows and sheep and stuff when they send them off for, you know what they do. And so they'd have these bulls there, and their heads would stick out. You know, instead of having two floors of animals like they normally do, they'd have one floor of animals, and their heads would sometimes stick out the top of the wagon. They were so big. So, you know, by our estimations, that's quite a big bull, but Aristasura was gigantic. The hump on it, whoever's been to India would see these Brahma bulls where they have the hump on their back. So it's said that the clouds actually mistook the hump on his back for a mountain. Yeah? And you see sometimes with mountains, they have the clouds, they hang around the mountains, and sometimes they look like a nightcap, you know, those hats they have. It looked like a nightcap on the mountain. So the clouds were hanging around his hump like that. So you can imagine how tall he was. And then later on we'll see, he became angry and he was like flicking his tail up in the air. And as he's flicking his tail up in the air, it was moving the clouds hither and thither, it describes. So with this gigantic size, you can just imagine what it sounded like when he was bellowing. He was just roaring so loudly, it was creating such a disturbance. Pada, with his hooves, cha, and virikan, scraping, mahim, the ground, Udyamya, raising upward. Putsham, his tail. So you can see this is a description. He's very angry, you know. He's scraping the ground with his horns. He's like flicking his tail up in the air. He's getting very annoyed. I actually remember when I was a child living in East Malvern, and we used to go to Lloyd Street State School, and sometimes we'd take a shortcut home. And I only did this once or twice because it was really scary, because there was these tennis courts, and the people were keeping this bull in the tennis courts. It was in the middle of the city. I don't know why they were doing that. You couldn't do stuff like that these days. Anyhow, I didn't realise the bull was there, and I don't think he realised we were there at first. And then when he saw us, he became very angry, and he's like, you know how they scrape the ground with the hooves and stuff like that. And we shot up over the fence as soon as we saw this guy. It was pretty wild, but you know, you could sort of get an idea what an angry bull is like. Viprani, the embankments. Vishana, of his horns. Agrena, with the tips. Cha, and. Udharam, lifting and tearing. Kinchit, a little. Shakrit, stool. Muncham, releasing. Mutrayam, urinating. So it's describing here how he's passing stool and urine all over the place. Now we see different times that living entities would pass stool and urine like that. One is when they're in fear of death. So obviously he's not in fear of death. Another time that a living entity might pass stool and urine around the place is when they're trying to show contempt or to defile a place. Just like we see when Lord Shiva came with his followers to destroy the Daksha Yagya, then the followers of Lord Shiva, they were urinating all over the Yagya pit just to defile the place. You know, they did many other things, where they chopped off the head of Daksha and things like that, but they also urinated all over the place just to show their contempt and to defile the sacred arena. So in the same way here, we see that Aristasura, he's passing urine and stool all over the place just to show his contempt to Krishna, because he was sent there to kill Krishna by Kamsa, so he's just come there to defile the place and show his contempt. And we see, actually, it's really interesting that in this modern, you know, so-called modern society, that they talk about how civilized and how modern they are, and how primitive, these old cultures were. And how advanced we are now, because we've got all this like technology, we can fly in the sky, we can dig holes under the ground and have subways and things like that. Yet, if we understand it through the perception that's given in the Vedic literature, we understand actually how backward this culture is, because in order to fly in the sky, they have to have these great big machines, which occasionally drop out of the sky and many hundreds of people are killed. Or in order to go through the earth, they have to have a big drilling machine, to go underneath the, like they put a tunnel underneath the channel in England. It was such a, by their estimation, such a great endeavor. Yet we see in the Vedic culture, it talks about the it talks about the different mystic cities, the Asta cities that the yogis attain, Anima, Lagima, Prapti. This one, Prapti, is interesting. It's called acquisition, where a yogi he can take anything from anywhere. It describes how he can extend his hand, and he can go to the moon and take something from the moon or anything like that, And Prabhupada describes how one of his friends, his guru, had this city, and he asked him one time. He asked Prabhupada's guru, friend's guru, asked him, "What would you like? Would you like some fruit?" And he says, "We want some pomegranate from the slopes of the Himalayas." So the yogi, he extended his hands and he went and got this and put it in the room. He said, "Go into the next room and you'll find it there." And they found it there fresh and still had dew on it from being picked in the morning like that. So in a Vedic culture, they can achieve all these different things, but very, very sophisticated. They don't need to have these big machines. And just like we see the yogis, they can also fly in the sky, but they don't need a jumbo jet, which takes so much endeavor to build. and if there's some small fault, then they crash out of the sky, or if there's too many flying around the airport at one time. Just like you can go to London Airport and a plane lands every 2 minutes. Just constantly, one plane after the next, after the next, after. And the only reason they can't have any more is because the air traffic controllers can't manage anymore. And they're actually, air traffic controllers is considered to be one of the most stressful jobs in the world. And they have a really high attrition rate, you know, people committing suicide and giving up the job just because of the stress of all these planes floating around the airport. You can imagine, you know, a place like London. At any given time, you'll see 10 or 15 airplanes circling around the airport waiting to land. And if someone makes a mistake, they crash, and then all those people are dead. Yeah? And Prabhupada, he gives an interesting comparison. He says, it's just like you see these planes, they're flying, they're hovering around the airport waiting to land, but there's so much risk of accident. He said, but you can see a lamp, you know, like now the spring's coming up, we'll probably start getting the flying ants, especially if you go to Mayapur just before Gopanim time. They get these plagues of flying ants, they come. And there's millions upon millions. You come in the morning, Prabhupada's Vyasasana is just, and Prabhupada also, is just covered in flying ants. And you see them when they go around the lights, you know, you'll have thousands of them just buzzing around the lights, or moths just buzzing around the lights. But how many collisions are there? Not one. Huh? They don't need an air traffic controller. Huh? Don't need radios or anything. No, there's not one collision. You know, so Krishna's creation is very sophisticated and very, you know, quite perfect. Everything works quite well. And we see that, how people are sort of glorifying, you know, how modern and advanced we are in this day and age. Yet things don't work so well. You know? And we see that you know, people, they pass stool and urine practically anywhere. You know, like when we come to the temple every day, there's this laneway just down the end here near Mill Street, and we walk through the laneway. And people just use it for a place for their dogs to pass stool. Very, very. I mean, and you go for a walk on the beach, you've got to be careful where you're walking. You know, people make a joke about it in India. You know, oh, you've got to be careful when you go on the beach there, because people go down, you know, because it's very convenient for them. They just go, you know, just below the high tide mark, they pass stool there, and the tide comes and washes it out. Yeah? And they think this is very convenient. But actually, this is very offensive, because they're disrespecting the personality in the ocean. They're disrespecting Varuna. You shouldn't do things like this. But they do, because lack of culture, lack of civilization. So we see the same here in this world. You know, it's like you'll find that they have to put signs up in places where they prepare food that you should wash your hands after you go to the bathroom. You don't have to tell a civilized person to wash their hands after you go to the bathroom. They know that you do that. That's just human life. Yeah, we'll see, you know, like in this modern day, you know, so-called modern, that you have to instruct people to wash their hands after they go to the bathroom. You have to instruct them to wash their hands after they eat, so many things, you know. And yet they've got this illusion of how cultured they are and how civilized they are. So we see here that Aristasura, he's understanding what he's doing. He's understanding that he's insulting Krishna. He's showing contempt by his behavior. This is one way of showing contempt. You know, it's like you go into someone's house and you urinate on the floor, like Krishna did when he was a child. You know, like he would, when they would hang the yogurt pots from the roof so high that he couldn't reach them, there wasn't things for him to stack up and reach them. So he'd go into the bedroom, he'd pinch the babies to wake them up, he'd urinate on the floor and run away. You know, just to show contempt, you know, just to, you know, disturb them. So we see here that Aristasura, he's doing the same thing. I'll just read the translation. Aristasura bellowed very harshly and pawed the ground. With his tail raised and his eyes glaring, he began to tear up the embankments with the tips of his horns, every now and then passing a little stool and urine. And Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says here and there he was passing stool and urine. So he's going all over the place and just passing stool and urine just to show contempt and contaminate things. And we see also he's manifesting a lot of, he's stirred up, you know, he's just really angry, he's showing Krishna, you know, that I'm so strong, I'm so powerful, I'm going to kill you, you know. And you see, like, sometimes you'll see bulls when they get really wound up, they start to sort of dig into the embankments with their horns and stuff like that. You know, like sometimes they just, like, they scratch the ground with their hooves, you know, just showing a little bit of that they're getting a bit frisky, but when they get really wound up, they do things like this. And then, as we'll see, as the pastime unfolds, Krishna just is so, he just disregards him completely. not interested in him at all, you know, and he starts to slap his arms like this and clap his hands, right, we'll have you, sort of thing, you know. And then he even just like puts his arm on a friend's shoulder and just like looks at him, so what are you going to do? You know, he's just very nonchalant, you know. Even I was listening some time ago about, I mentioned last class how I was listening to Mahabharata, and there's one story there where the Pandavas, they're staying, it's after the house of Varanabhata, and they're staying in Ekachakra in the house of a Brahmin couple there, and they have two children. And there was this demon Bakasura who used to live nearby, different Bakasura from what's mentioned here in the Bhagavatam. And this Bakasura, he had, because the king was very weak in this area, and he had worked out a deal with the people that, okay, I won't harass you if it was either every week or every month that you provide me, you know, a cartload of food and someone to eat. You know? So they did that, and it turned out that it was this Brahmin's turn. So someone from his family had to go and get eaten by the demon. And so they were mortified about this, and they were, you know, like, each person was volunteering that it should be me who does it. You know, it's kind of different from what we experience these days, you know. Just imagine if it was your family's turn to feed the demon. Oh, you go, you know. We'd all trying to push the other person forward. But actually, in a cultured society, you see that everyone's saying, oh, actually, you know, no, I should go because I don't actually have any real function in the family. I'm of no worth, and, you know, if the child dies, there'll be this problem, if the wife dies, but, you know, they're all rationalizing, like, it's very nice. And then Kunti overhears it, and then she said, well, my son Bhima, he can go. You know, and of course, he's into it, you know, because Bhima likes fighting, he likes killing demons and stuff like that. He's very much enthused with these things. And anyhow, I won't tell the whole story because it goes on for quite a while. But basically, what happened is Bhima, as he was going along the way to meet the demon, he was eating the cart of food. Huh? And then he got to the place, and the demon saw that the cart was almost empty, and Bhima's still standing there, and the demon's roaring out, and Bhima turned his back to him and just keeps eating, you know. And then the demon comes running up, and both hands together, like, clenches his fist and bangs him in the back, and Bhima just keeps eating like nothing happened. And then he washes his hands, and he finishes up and turns around and looks at the demon, you know. So he just shows contempt for him. Yeah? So we see that. So Krishna, in the same way, he shows contempt for this demon because he's not bothered by him. I mean, who's going to kill Krishna, really, when you think of it? And that's the demoniac mentality. Is we see that many of these demons, they actually know that Krishna is God. They know that Vishnu is God. But the mistake is they think they're going to kill God. So really, they don't understand what God means if they think that, oh, I'm going to kill God. And this is the nature of a demon. So we see here, this is getting back into chapter is getting back into the different pastimes of Krishna interacting with demons. And the pastimes that Krishna performs are broken into two prominent categories. It's called Nitya Leela and Naimittika Leela. So Nitya means like the particularly first, the Astakaliya Leela, the eight pastimes that go on every day that Krishna performs. And they're all performed at specific times. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he describes in the Chaitanya Shikshamrita how these Nitya Leela, these are the pastimes that are occurring in the spiritual realm in Goloka Vrindavan. Whereas the Naimittika Leela, with the occasional pastimes, which essentially refers to like when Krishna, for instance, goes to Mathura. Because Krishna never leaves Goloka, he doesn't actually go anywhere. But when he's here on this planet, he performs different pastimes. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur describes how the Naimittika pastimes mix with the Nitya, and they're working together. Yet the Naimittika pastimes, particularly, or which refers essentially to his leaving Vrindavan, and also the pastimes interacting with demons, killing demons, these things don't happen in Goloka. They only happen here in this material realm. Yet we see that there is, like, once Prabhupada was asked about this, is there any demons in Goloka Vrindavan? And Prabhupada said no, but there is rumours of demons. Yeah? So the demons don't come there, but they hear about, oh, there's a demon coming, let's take shelter of Krishna. Because if that rumour wasn't there, then that exchange of the gopis and the residents of Vrindavan, etc., taking shelter of Krishna, would not be there. So it needs to be there in one sense, so they can take shelter of Krishna in that way. And we see that actually in the spiritual realm there is no negativity. There's no, you know, bad things don't happen there. But still, there's these rumors, oh, this is happening, this is coming. So that the residents of Vrindavan can take shelter of Krishna in this way. But these pastimes, the Naimittika pastimes, they happen here, only in the material realm. So this pastime here of killing Aristasura is also something that happens only here in this material realm. Then Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he goes on to describe the nature of these Naimittika pastimes. And he points out how all these different pastimes we see, you know, particularly in this 10th canto, these can only actually be understood by persons who have accepted the transcendental nature of the Lord. Because we see that if a materialistic person tries to understand the pastimes of the Lord, what happens is they become bewildered by Maya and they're just attracted by the mundane sex aspect. They just think these are mundane pastimes. Because when you think of it, you know, a little boy, you know, he's probably about 7 years old now. He's engaged in these pastimes of killing this demon that's as big as a mountain. Mm-hmm. And people are going to say, oh yeah, right, that's pretty far out. Mm-hmm. You know, what do you think, he's Superman or something? You know, they have like this comic book idea of like, you know, I think it was called Marvel's Comics, you know, with all the superheroes. That's their idea of like someone who can perform extraordinary tasks. It's just fictitious. They don't believe it's true. Yet for a devotee, you know, someone who's actually understood the transcendental nature of the name, form, quality and pastimes of the Lord, you know, he's accepting these things. This is the absolute truth. This is Krishna performing wonderful pastimes with his associates. And as it's pointed out by Rupa Goswami, he says, Atasya Krishna Namadi, Navavet Graya Mindre, Sevan Mukihi Jivara Swayameva Spuratya Daha. That no one can understand the transcendental nature of the name, form, quality and pastimes of the Lord through materially contaminated senses. It's only when one's senses become purified by the process of devotional service that one can understand the nature of Krishna. Now Krishna says that in the Gita, in a couple of places actually. He says, Bhakti Mama Vidyananti, Yadanyas Chasmi Tathpadaha. That is, only by devotional service can I be understood as I am. Krishna is revealing to Arjuna, you want to understand me, this is the method by devotional service. So in the same way, these pastimes, Bhaktivinoda Thakur discusses how like devotees should not reveal these intimate pastimes to non-devotees because they just become bewildered. And in their bewildered state, they become offenders. They think that, oh, this Krishna is just an ordinary boy. He's just engaging in ordinary lusty affairs, particularly the chapters we just finished reading. They just become, you know, he's involved in ordinary lusty affairs. He's having illicit relationships with other people's wives in the forest at night. What kind of God is this? And they just think it's just all nonsense. So generally speaking, and we see that actually Mahaprabhu, when he was manifesting his pastimes here on this planet, he did not discuss, you know, the intimate pastimes of Krishna with practically with anyone. They said he discussed it with 3.5 people. Now why the half is given, I don't know, but anyhow. They said with Srup Damodar, with Ramananda Roy, with Sikhi Mahiti and Sikhi Mahiti's sister. These are the only people that Mahaprabhu would discuss his intimate pastimes of rasa. And even like with philosophy, we don't see that Mahaprabhu would discuss philosophy with everyone. You know, you see like when he was with Prakashananda Saraswati in Varanasi, he discussed philosophy, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, he discussed philosophy. But generally speaking, what Mahaprabhu would do, he would just have these long kirtans that would go out for 4 or 5 hours of time, just have these long harinams and just engage people in chanting of Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. Because unless they accept, you know, unless there's some purification has taken place, then people cannot understand this philosophy. And, you know, I'm sure that we've all had this experience that when we first, you know, were introduced to Krishna consciousness and started to practice Krishna consciousness, a lot of the philosophy just seems so bewildering. It just seems so alien. You know, especially for those of us who have come from Western backgrounds, the practices and the philosophy of Krishna consciousness, you know, like just the whole idea of how we wash ourselves after we pass stool just seem like so weird. You know, you actually do it with your hand. You know, for a lot of people that's very, very difficult to accept, you know. And, you know, like, I know that sometimes, you know, when you go out to different places, my inclination is that I want to eat with my hands because I just find it's a very nice way of experiencing the food, you know. Just yet a lot of people, they become very disturbed when they see people eating with their hands. They think it's just like, you know, animalistic that someone might eat with their hands. Yet we understand it's a very, you know, cultured way of eating. And actually, I remember doing a seminar years ago in Vrindavan with Bhakti Chirumaraj and Sarvabhavana, and they were discussing about how it was a cooking seminar, and they were discussing how when you're eating, there's different facets of the eating, and the first thing is that you see the food, so that's the beginning of the digestive process, and you smell the food, and then you touch the food as you're, you know, and even through the sense of touch, you know, because the senses, they experience the food and they taste the food to some extent, and this, you know, apparently activates subtle things within the body that get the sort of the right digestive juices going to deal with that food, and then you put it into your mouth. It's a whole sort of process. Yet in the West they have this whole like clinical way of approaching it. You have your knife and your fork, and it's very interesting. They have the fork in their left hand, you know, and they eat with their left hand. They cut it all up and they stick these, you know, prong things into the mouth, and they think this is very cultured. And they stick their little pinkies out while they're doing it. You know? It looks so silly, you know. The nose and the little pinky stuck up in the air. You know, they make a big philosophy about it. A big, you know, they have all these bright books about how to do it, and they have, you know, make fancy Wedgwood tea sets, and so much endeavour just for these basic animal propensities. Yet, how much endeavour do they make to understand who they really are? What is their nature? What is their duty in this world? They make no endeavour. No endeavour whatsoever. Yeah? And they think that, you know, like, and you see, particularly if you go to places like England, of course, you know, here in Australia there's some element of English cultures there, but they get right into all this, like, ritual of like, you know, they have their tea party, for instance, you know, and they drink the tea, and it's, you know, like, I remember my grandmother. She was a big tea drinker. You know, so my mother and father, they didn't drink tea very much, but my grandmother, she was a big tea drinker. And there's this whole ritual about how to make a pot of tea. You know, and they used to have all these slogans about, you know, you have to take the pot to the kettle, not the kettle to the pot. You have to turn it around 3.5 times this way and 3.5 times back that way, and, you know, one for each cup and one for the pot, and all this like ritual they came up with just for this act of drinking an intoxicant. You know. Yet how much endeavour do they make for Krishna? Yeah. So we see, you know, like even though this society is presented as being very cultured, you know, or very, you know, developed or elevated, or you know, very modern, you know, but actually if you analyse it and compare it to Vedic, with the Vedic understanding, then you'll see that actually that it's not even a culture, it's subhuman. Yeah. I was listening to a lecture, and Prabhupada was talking the other day about this. I can't remember the detail of what he was saying anymore. But he was talking about that, how this whole culture is actually subhuman, because they're engaged in activities that, you know, just like we've seen in Hitopadesha, says this activities of eating, sleeping, mating and defending are similar both to man and animals. Yet if a man doesn't engage in dharma, then he's no better than an animal, because this is adhiko vishesho. This is the special feature of human life. This vishesha means special. This is a special feature of human life, is that we engage in dharma. This is our business. This is what we're here for. Not here to develop some artificial culture about how to drink a cup of tea with your little pinky stuck out in the air. You know? It's such a silly, inane culture. No, the business of human life is to develop our religiosity, to understand who we are and what this life is meant for. And this is the beauty of the Vedic culture, because the whole Vedic culture is just built around this principle of understanding God, of understanding who I am and how to serve God. The whole Vedic culture is directed towards that, whereas materialistic culture is simply directed towards how to enjoy my senses more and more. And the problem with that is, yeah, fine, you can enjoy your senses, but where does it lead you? Adoga janati tamasaha, leads you down and down into darker and darker species of life. So we see here, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he discusses these different demons in the Chaitanya. It's actually chapter 6 in Chaitanya Shikshamrita. He talks about all the demons that appear in Krishna's Leela, and he gives, he relates them to, there's 20 anartas, main anartas. He quotes from the Krishna Samhita, and in the Krishna Samhita he says there's 19 mentioned there, and this is plus this other one which is related, I think it was Vyomasura. No, sorry, the Yamalajun trees, which is being proud of wealth. And then, so he relates all the different demons that appeared in Krishna's Leela that were killed by Krishna and Balaram. and connects them all with different anarthas. So with Aristasura, he says Aristasura represents the demon, the anatta of disregard for bhakti and attachment to cheating religion, false religious principles. And then he goes into some... He doesn't actually give much explanation on Aristasura. On some of the other ones, he gives quite a bit of explanation. But with Aristasura, he says that this disregard. And we see that you know, because Krishna's, as it's described in the previous purport, Aristasura came in the evening time, around twilight. And at this point, you know, Krishna was thinking about going out into the forest to enjoy rasa dance with the gopis. So Krishna's got Aristasura has come there with complete disregard for, you know, the pastimes of Krishna, complete disregard for the residents of Vrindavan, and he's just there, you know, just creating a disturbance. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur goes on to describe how if we are able to, he says, you know, he talks about how these different demons represent these anarthas. He says, by taking shelter of Krishna and praying humbly and sincerely to Krishna, destroy these anarthas, just like you've destroyed these demons in the same way you've destroyed these demons, then gradually all these anarthas will disappear from the heart. And he also points out that the connection between the Naimittika Leela and the anarthas of the living entity, he's saying, just like the Naimittika Leela only takes place here in the material world, so in the material world only do you have these different anarthas. And by taking shelter of these different pastimes and reading them regularly and understanding, then we can overcome all these different anarthas. So there's no purport to this one. I'll read on a bit. Yasha nihradita nenanga nishturena gavam ninam patantya kalato harpa shavanti sma bayinavai nivishanti kanayasya kakudyachara shankaya tantikshna shingam udviksha gopya gopash chatatrasu. Translation: my dear king, clouds hovered about sharp-horned Aristasura's hump, mistaking it for a mountain. And when the cowherd men and ladies caught sight of the demon, they were struck with terror. Indeed, the strident reverberation of his roar so frightened the pregnant cows and women that they lost their fetuses in miscarriages. So we see here it's describing the size of Aristasura, how big he was, that his hump on his back was mistaken for a mountain by the clouds. And it's interesting, we see this in all these different pastimes, the residents of Vrindavan, and also many devotees, is whenever they're presented with a fearful situation, their natural inclination, they don't have to think about it, it's just their natural inclination is to take shelter of Krishna. And this is a way that we can also assess ourselves as we're taking, as we're making advancement, or as we're practicing devotional service, is when difficult times come, what do we take shelter of? It's just like we see, like Kunti, she prays, I think, is Vipatara Shantatasha Tattra Tattra Jagatguru Bhavato Dasham Nyasham Apunam Bhavadashanam. That she's praying to the Lord Krishna, he says, my dear Lord, you let those calamities come again and again. Quite extraordinary, you know, someone's actually praying. You know, in modern terms, that would be considered masochistic. You know? Well, they want to suffer. Mm-hmm. But actually, you know, Kunti explains why she wants those calamities to come, because she said, when the calamities come, then we think of you, we take shelter of you. And then when we take shelter of you, we no longer fear repeated birth and death. So in the same way, we see the residents of Vrindavan, and actually all devotees, whenever they're presented with some difficulty, with some calamity, they take shelter of Krishna. And this is a way that we can understand ourselves, actually, whether or not we're making advancement in devotional service. Do we take shelter of Krishna? Or do we try to take shelter of our own prowess? And often we'll see that when calamity comes, some people try to take shelter of their... Just like we see with these demons, you know, they're thinking by their own strength, by my own prowess, that I'll be able to, you know, overcome this Krishna. And, you know, throughout these pastimes, when the forest fire was there, and the cowherd boys, they just run, oh Krishna, please save us from this fire. Yeah? They don't think about, you know, like what we call it, the fire brigade. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Come put the fire out. But we see, you know, I mean, just like in a couple of years back, they had those big fires. The fire brigade couldn't do anything. Completely, you know, ineffective. Couldn't do anything about it. The fire was so big. And we see that also in this material world, the fire of material life is so strong. On our own, we have no ability to overcome it. We cannot overcome it on our own. We need to take shelter. And there's a very interesting verse in the 11th canto which points this out, where it's stating, what is that verse? It says, Anadi avidya yuktasha purushasha forgot the last half anyway, I know the translation. That says, because the conditioned living entity has been covered by ignorance since time immemorial, he's not capable of effecting his own self-realization. Therefore, there must be some other person who is in factual knowledge of the absolute truth. Not someone who just has some like armchair, you know, sort of understanding of, you know, like an intellectual understanding. No, someone who's in factual knowledge, someone who has realized knowledge, someone who knows what the absolute truth is. And is able to impart this knowledge to them. This is the thing. This is realization. If you have realization, then you're able to impart. If you just have gyan essentially means book knowledge. If you just possess the gyan, then okay, you know something. But how are you able to impart that to others? But if you have vigyan, realized knowledge, then that person can actually explain this knowledge to you, and help you to understand, help you to see the truth. And that's the position of the living entities in this material world, is we've been covered since, it says, anadi avidya. Anadi means eternal. Since time immemorial. Avidya yuktasha. The living entity has been covered by ignorance since time immemorial. Not capable of affecting our own self-realization. Therefore, Sukadeva Goswami, there must be some other person who is in factual knowledge. Not just some, you know, like armchair, as we're saying, some armchair understanding or some intellectual understanding. Factual knowledge, absolute truth, and they can impart this knowledge. This is the essence. It is, in order for a person to develop their spiritual understanding, there must be transmissal of knowledge. And this is the beginning point of it. It's called sambandhigyan, where we understand the nature of our relationship. So that gets back to the verse we were talking about before, how Rupa Goswami is pointing out. He says that, you know, the one who cannot understand the transcendental nature of the form, quality and pastimes of the Lord through materially contaminated senses. So when there's some bandhigyan is there, this is the beginning of the awakening of realization of the nature of the self. And then as that develops more and more, then the senses become purified. The senses actually, you know, return to their original function or the original purpose, which is to serve Krishna. And in this way the senses become purified, become spiritualized. As long as the senses... Actually, I was listening to an interesting definition Prabhupada was talking about the other day. He's saying how actually everything is spiritual. There is, you know, this perception of material world is just illusion. It's not really there. There is no material, you know, there's no matter as such. But he's saying what makes it material is that we separate it from Krishna. So as long as we separate our senses, as long as we separate our mind and intelligence from Krishna, then it's considered to be material. But as soon as we take those same elements, there's no difference. You know, there's no difference between my senses and the senses of a non-devotee. It's just what I do with my senses. That's what's different. So because they're connected with Krishna, then they become spiritual. So as long as we use the mind, the body, the intelligence to serve Krishna, it's spiritual. And as soon as we don't use it to serve Krishna, then it becomes contaminated and it's material. So this is the key to success in spiritual life, is to keep our mind, our body, and our intelligence, all our senses engaged fully in serving Krishna. And Prabhupada uses that analogy, just like he says, when you put the iron rod into the fire, you leave it there long enough, and it takes on the quality of fire. It becomes hot. Red hot, white hot even, if you leave it, if the fire is hot enough. And, you know, if you fan it, you have a forge and that, you fan it. It becomes white hot. And as long as it's there in the fire, it has all the quality of fire. It will give off light, it will give off heat, it has the capacity to burn. It's a very good analogy, this, when you sort of analyze and dissect it. But as soon as you take this iron rod out of the fire, it starts to lose
the quality of fire. And if you put it into water, then instantly the quality of fire has gone. So in the same way, the living entity, you know, if we're engaged in Krishna's service, then we have all the qualities of Krishna. We don't become Krishna. This is not possible. But we have all the qualities of Krishna. And as long as we, you know, this is why Prabhupada uses this, the fire of devotional service. As long as we remain in the fire of devotional service, then we have all these transcendental qualities. But as soon as we back off from that, yeah, oh, okay, now I've made enough spiritual advancement, I don't need to apply myself anymore, I can just, you know, rest on my laurels, so to speak, then we start to lose. And we see that devotees who lose their enthusiasm in devotional service, then gradually they start to lose their spiritual qualities. But if they go diving into the material pool, which is a very, very cold pool, then that fire is put out straight away. So it's a very good analogy and helps us understand very clearly this position. So by keeping ourselves always active in the practice of devotional service, always thinking of Krishna, always in his service, always, as he says in the Gita, you know, always think of me, become my devotee, worship me, and offer your homage unto me. Thus you will come to me without fail. He says this to Arjuna. You'll come to me without fail. Ma sucha, what's that? Asangsayam. He says this many times throughout the Gita. Without a doubt, you will come to me. So the thing is, he's saying to Arjuna, always, he says, you know, Manmana Bhava Madbhakto Madhyajima, always engage in my service, always think of me, become, you know, don't have a break for a minute from this, and then you'll come to me. But if we approach devotional service like, you know, half-heartedly, you know, we've not actually fully engaged in devotional service, then we'll definitely make advancement, but the advancement will be restricted. And the more we're able to engage in devotional service, and the more we'll find that our mind, intelligence and senses will become. And in this way, as Rupa Goswami describes, is that by engaging the mind, intelligence, sense, and service, then we actually understand the transcendental nature of the name, form, qualities, and pastimes of the Lord. And then, actually, as Bhaktivinoda Thakur describes, he says that these pastimes that are described in this 10th canto, they're so cherishable by them, they're so valuable to the devotees, they're the sweetest thing. I was discussing this with my wife yesterday. She said how she's reading this previous chapter, and she's getting so much satisfaction out of reading this chapter. Because for the devotees, these pastimes are very pleasing. To hear the way that Krishna is interacting with his devotees, to hear the way that Krishna is dealing with these demons, very, very pleasing. To hear, you know, that story is told about Lord Chaitanya, how he met that brahmana, you know, that so-called illiterate brahmana in South India, and the brahmana was crying. And all the you know, the local people were laughing at him. Well, because you're literally reading the Bhagavad Gita, you're a servant. He allows himself to become the child. He interacts with devotees in these very, very intimate ways, in these very pleasing ways, in order to increase the rasa, in order to increase the relationship, the taste. And not just for the devotees, because he himself, his taste is also increasing by this exchange. He's getting so much satisfaction from the exchange. He's getting so much pleasure. Just like we see that it says in the Gita, it says, the thoughts of my pure devotees dwell in me, and their lives are fully devoted to my service. And they derive great satisfaction, it says, and bliss by always enlightening one another and conversing about me. So the devotees get a lot of satisfaction from the pastimes, discussing the pastimes. But Krishna also gets satisfaction out of this. So all around it's a mutually rewarding situation. So we're very fortunate in this Krishna consciousness movement that we actually have access to these wonderful pastimes, because by studying these pastimes, you know, regularly hearing them, reading them, and you know, actually Bhaktivinoda Thakur mentions, you know, as same as Prabhupada says about the Brahma Samhita, if we enter into these things as a daily function, every day, you know, Prabhupada encouraged devotees to read Krishna book at night, or at least to read Bhagavatam every day. And if every day we're entering into these pastimes, reading these pastimes, trying to understand and remembering about these pastimes, then this is going to help us to make rapid advancement in devotional service. And we'll find that our life is very, very pleasing for us, you know. And I just reflect on that often, how fortunate I feel that I'm very, very fortunate, and we're all fortunate to have this opportunity to hear about Krishna's pastimes. I mean, you look at what materialistic people, what do? They read the newspaper.
They hear about, you know, how someone set off bombs in this country, or, you know, someone was shooting children at this school. Mataji was telling us how there's this, you know, in Montreal a few, I don't know, last week or something, someone was shooting up people at the school. And I mean, not very attractive. Does it make you want to stay here in the material world when you hear these pastimes? But if you come immersed in them, that's what's going to happen to you. But then when you hear Krishna's pastimes, when you read Krishna's pastimes, you become attracted. Oh, you know, I'd like to go there. Actually, there's one story where Prabhupada, someone was reading to him from Krishna book, and then he turned to the voice and said, "That I want." He said, "I just want to eat Krishna's laddu." So he's thinking like that. I want to return to the spiritual world. I want to eat Krishna's laddu. So for the devotees also, by hearing these pastimes, we'll actually develop this attraction that, yes, I want to go there. I want to steal laddu from Krishna's lunchbox. Because you can do that. It's not a problem. The cowherd boys are doing it all the time. And he's stealing laddu from their lunchboxes too. He's doing this all the time. It's going on constantly. So we're very, I mean, just, you cannot estimate your good fortune. What's that verse, Sukadeva Goswami says, Punya Krita Krita. He's talking about, you know, the fortune of the cowherd boys, how much punya they have. He says you cannot estimate their punya, because here they are, they're engaging in pastimes directly with Krishna, with the Supreme Person of Godhead. So also for us, we cannot estimate our good fortune. Here we are, we're sitting in Krishna's mandir, directly in front of the Supreme Person of Godhead and his most beloved consort. We can come here every day. Who can do that? Who has that good fortune? Every day they can come and see God. So it's nice if we can, you know, reflect on that, how fortunate we are, and never take this process of Krishna consciousness for granted. Always try to remain very serious about this. Don't take for granted the good fortune you have, because it may not always be here. And if we are negligent in our activities, if we're negligent in our approach to the Lord, then we may lose that opportunity. So it's always good to... It's just like, you know, sometimes you see, you know, the parents, they give the child some, you know, opulence, and the child just takes it for granted and just leaves it lying around the place and things like that, you know. And it gets broken. They lose it. You know? Or the parents may take it away. So the thing is, we should never take these things for granted, because it may be taken away from us. We have the most incredible good fortune. You just cannot estimate the good fortune we have to be able to serve Krishna. So please don't take that for granted. Please, you know, reflect on your good fortune every day, and offer our gratitude to Krishna and to Srila Prabhupada for giving us this position, or giving us this, you know, wonderful good fortune. So thank you very much. And then, is there any questions at all?
How the quality group keeps us in the material world in heaven?
The essence of false ego is thinking that I am the body. So as long as you have that perception that I am the body, you're forced to stay in the material world. You have no choice. True ego means I am the servant of Krishna. And that is the mentality of those in the spiritual world, in Goloka Vrindavan. Everyone is just thinking that, you know, they're servants of Krishna. They're just engaged in pastimes of Krishna. So false ego is actually, it's interesting, there's different descriptions given of the layers of the universes. And each layer is 10 times thicker than the first one, so the 10 times thicker than the previous one. So some descriptions say that the false ego is the last layer, and it's the biggest layer of all. So, you know, and you really have to struggle to get through that one. So, yeah, I mean, the false ego just, you know, as long as we had this misperception that I am this body, because this, you know, because when you think I'm the body, you think I'm the enjoyer. This material world is the place where we think I'm the enjoyer. You cannot, you know, think that I'm the enjoyer in the spiritual world. There's no room for that, because Krishna, he is the supreme enjoyer, and everything is centered around him. Yet here in the material world, then everything is centered around the individual, and we see that, you know, this society is more and more becoming like that. It's more and more becoming, you know, it used to be at least it was family centered or nation centered,
But now it's just individual-centered. Everyone just is looking for what they can get out of it. It's all about the individual. And it's becoming more that way. And you'll find that, you know, even like we'll find relationships will develop that way. Relationships will just be a casual thing. You know, it'll just be a casual exchange of sex just for a bit of enjoyment. And you'll find that the marriages will become practically non-existent as Kali Yuga develops. This is all predicted in the Bhagavatam. You know, the marriage will be just on mutual agreement. It will also be broken on mutual agreement. Becoming more and more individual. As we see, as Kali Yuga takes you know, hold more and more, this is going to become prominent. Something else? Okay. Grantara Srimad Bhagavatam ki.